you're looking at the mindset. So, for example, if you're aware that you've woken up and you've got the, oh my God, you're rubbish, the day is going to be terrible, you can then take a stand back and then say, oh, okay, this stuff's playing out again. There's a difference between seeing, oh, this stuff's playing out again, than qualifying that as, I am terrible, I am a disaster. So the ability to create that space between, okay, I know what this is just my kind of critic playing out again, and I have a choice here to observe this and not to get over-involved.
Owen O'Kane is a psychotherapist and former NHS clinical lead for mental health. He says there are daily things we can do to help us become our own therapists. This is the Lizarre Wellbeing Show, the podcast helping us all have a better second half. I'm Lizarre, and I'm on a bit of a mission to find ways for all of us to thrive in later life by investing in our health and our well-being today. Well, how do you feel when I say the word therapy? Fearful? Overwhelmed? Curious? Well, over the years, I've become more of a fan, I have to say, and I've come to realise there is more than one kind of therapy, and that finding what works for you is really worth the effort, whether it's using something like EFT, which we've talked about on this podcast before, to help overcome deep trauma, or maybe having relationship counselling with someone like James Earle, no relation, who writes such a brilliant regular therapy column for the Lizarre Wellbeing magazine, or maybe you prefer to do a bit of self-talk with mindful moments and journaling, all really good forms of personal therapy and the kind of thing that I turn to more often these days to help sort out what is going on in my head. Well, with dual medical and psychotherapy training, Owen has over 25 years of experience working inside people's heads with mental health and more. And he has a wonderful ability to understand not just how to quell anxiety and manage stress, but how to bring happiness and calm into people's lives too. And I think we're all well aware of the barriers to entry when it comes to therapy in the UK, waiting lists and cost in particular. So Owen has written a brilliant book. It's called How to Be Your Own Therapist, which, while it's not a replacement for therapy, highlights that we don't need to be spending hours on our mental well-being. In fact, just 10 minutes at home each day can make a real difference to our state of mind.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Oh, Owen, welcome. And do you know, I think around this time of year, the month that we're in now, we've maybe become just a little bit more realistic about the fact that we're not necessarily going to be making the grand changes we might have promised ourselves at the beginning of the new year. But we don't have to make huge changes in order to be happier, do we? Because you are here to extol the virtues of small and manageable tweaks for every day.
That's what I think. I mean, I often talk about micro injections because I think they're more effective. And you know what we know from all the research, I mean, we talk, January is always about resolutions and change and kind of revamping your life, but the research is really clear that most resolutions by the third week in January haven't come to anything.
Right.
And when we start to dig deeper, and I don't want that to sound like negative or pessimistic to start the show, but the reason most of them don't come to anything is that most people set their resolutions too high. They set the bar way too high. Mm. And it becomes overwhelming. So they're not realistic. And I guess really what I'm interested, like, it's a very interesting thing for me because most of the resolutions, when I go on Instagram and stuff around January time, all of the resolutions are about the external stuff, you know, change your body, change your life, change your job. And in my experience of doing this work over the years, when people focus on the external stuff to feel happier, I've rarely seen it work very well. Mm. So I guess really what I'm interested in is the kind of the internal tweaks, you know, the change of mindset, how mm-hmm. you manage the emotional stuff. Mm. What are things that even take you one step forward? Because very often they can be monumentally powerful for the bigger changes longer term. So that's sort of the direction I take. And I think for most people, it works much better.
I think that's a really interesting point, actually. I mean, one of the things that I've learned over the years and that I've heard many therapists say is that we can't control what is happening to us in that external environment, but we can control how we respond. And I guess that's what you're saying. It's we can control and have more authority over what's going on inside. And actually, ultimately, that's more important.
I would say probably 95% of people I meet when they come to therapy, they'll come in and they will talk about all of the various things that are going on in their life. And they will say, I'm struggling, I'm unhappy, I'm anxious, whatever the context might be. And often they will kind of place blame on the situation. You know, it's because of my life, my past, what happened, my other half, my boss. And there might be some degree of truth in that. So I'm not kind of discounting the fact that these circumstances do contribute significantly to struggle. But rarely do you meet people coming in saying, I'm really struggling because of my approach or how right. I'm dealing with this or my perspective or my mindset. Now, you don't expect people to come up, but it's a really interesting transition because I guess my work and my books and the, you know, what I do is about helping people see most of the stuff, you know, like if we take other people, for example, you know, you can try as much as you can, but you're by and large, you're not going to change other people's behavior. Yeah. People are who they are, and getting frustrated with how people are and how they impact in your life. You know, unless you're willing to kind of make drastic changes, the key adjustment is on how you respond to them. And likewise with most of life, I mean, I think the pandemic taught us that, didn't it, really? None of us really have any significant control about what's going to come next. So kind of learning to navigate that, I think, is a really useful thing to do.
Yeah. Do you know, I'm just thinking of that right now and smiling because I had somebody come into my space just a few hours ago before we started this. Yeah. And they have a very, shall we say, negative energy. Mm-hmm. And whenever I see them, in the past, I've always been quite stressed by their visit. And in fact, I've kind of sometimes worked myself up into a bit of a state knowing that they were coming and reacted to it and thought afterwards, oh my gosh, this is all so dreadful, and taken on some of their negativity and kind of shouted it back or whatever. And today I just thought, actually, do you know what? This is just not going to touch me. I've got my shield up, my invisible shield, and I kind of visualize all these little arrows of stuff pinging at me, but actually they weren't getting through. And, you know, this person went off in a kind of, you know, cloud of, you know, grey smoke or whatever. And I just felt completely fine. And nothing had really changed. It was the same pattern of behaviour that I've experienced, you know, many, many times. But it was my own approach and how I framed it in my mind that actually meant that it didn't touch me.
That's it. I thought you were going to say you hid in the kitchen on the table.
I felt like it.
That's probably what I would have done.
No, I even offered them a cup of coffee. I mean, that is how strong I was feeling. You know, I was like, I'm going to manage this.
It's interesting. I think it's something about getting older as well. I've got much, much better at, you know, for, you know, I talk in one of my books about radiators and drains, you know, people in our lives, people that radiate us and lift us up, people who drag us down a bit. Mm-hmm. I think the older you get, I've sort of learned that if I'm around people who really are impacting negatively or actually draining you of all your resources, I mean, I'm much better at putting a boundary around that and thinking, actually, I'm not going to be unkind or I'm not going to be rude to somebody. Yeah. But actually, you know, in terms of what I do for a job and stuff, I've got to protect my own.
And I mean, this is going off on a tangent here, and you may think this is a bit woo-woo, but I've been looking at kind of vibrational energy and people who, there are people you're drawn to because they just seem to shine and they give off this really good vibe. And you talk about radiators and drains. I love that analogy. And actually, I've also been told that you need to be careful and watch out for those drains or those energy vampires, because they almost target those who've got what they haven't got. They kind of make a beeline for those whose energy is really, really good and kind of try and suck some of that out of it, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, because you've got what they haven't. And I think, you know, if you are feeling positive, you just need to be aware of who's coming into your space who might actually want to take some of that from you.
Yeah, and also really interesting interesting point. I had an old supervisor years ago who used to, you know, we go to supervision and we often talk about clients and how we do our work. And, you know, you're often kind of looking for another opinion if you get stuck with a client. And that's kind of part of the deal. Every therapist has their own supervisor and every therapist generally has their own therapist. But I remember a supervisor years ago said to me that, you know, you always have to take note of how you feel at the end of a session and what your own energy is like. And if you notice that you're working with a client and your energy is kind of significantly lower with this client most of the time, then you need to look about what that's about. And you have to think about how you protect your own space and your own energy around that. And it does happen all the time. You can see it sometimes where, you know, when you're working with people, and it might be that they're bringing very, very difficult stuff, but if they're stuck and they're resistant and they don't like, and this happens, and, you know, therapy can be a bit like a tug of war. And I, you know, I don't have a particularly fluffy approach to therapy. You know, I'm compassionate and I listen and I'm, you know, my key aim is to move someone forward. But sometimes that involves being quite tough. I've been quite challenging with people. And very often if people are stuck and they're in a mindset where they don't want to change or they're resistant, then you'll come up against, you know, a lot of that energetic stuff.
Interesting. And I'm interested that you say that you have a tough approach and not too fluffy. Let's talk about your background before we kind of go on to how we can become our own therapists. You grew up in Belfast during the Troubles. You know, how much of that has had an impact on your work and your values and perhaps your outlook now, you know, both as an adult and as a practitioner?
I mean, look, there's probably no better training ground. I talk a lot about anxiety and trauma. It's kind of my two key interest areas clinically. And I guess when you grow up somewhere like that, you know, you're sort of in a really, you're in a, it's like a training camp essentially, isn't it, for understanding the anxious mind and understanding trauma. And interestingly, during the time when I grew up there, you normalize it.
Right.
You know, you just kind of get normal. That it was funny, actually, you mentioned that because I watched the movie Belfast. I don't know if you've seen it. Watched a few months ago. I thought it was beautiful. I thought it was really beautifully made and acted and stuff. But it's interesting because it was set in a kind of more middle class part of Belfast, whereas I grew up in a very working class part of Belfast. And someone asked me afterwards in an interview what I thought of it. And for me, actually, it was like the Disney version.
Most
people were saying, oh my God, that was awful and what a terrible thing and all of those poems and stuff. Where actually, I thought they took quite a light approach to I think it was the right thing to do because it was from that perspective, you know, because that's where the character grew up. But for me, interestingly, when I grew up there, you normalize all of the stuff, you know, the bombs and the bullets and, you know, the day-to-day stuff and the constant threat of fear and not knowing what was coming next. I didn't see anything wrong with that at all until I left. So it was only when I moved to London And I basically started to rebuild my own life in a different way. It was only when I left and then when I sort of started doing my own therapy, really, in my early 20s, that suddenly the enormity of it and the impact sort of hit me. Because during the time, I guess, essentially, when you grow up somewhere like that, you're in survival mode.
Sure.
A lot of the time. So when you're in survival mode, you don't really have much time to be analysing or to working it out. You just get on with it. And on top of that as well, my family and, you know, culture was very Irish Catholic. And there was a get on with it, you know, and, you know, there are people worse off than you. So there was that mentality alongside it as well. So there wasn't really much permission to stop and stew in it. It was like, get on with it. Worst things happen in life.
Yeah. I mean, I was actually in Belfast last year. I took my kids. We went to the Titanic exhibition.
Which is amazing.
Which is fantastic. If anybody listening has not had the chance to go, please go. It is absolutely brilliant. And then we had a spare afternoon and we said, okay, we're going to get a cab and we're going to ask the taxi driver to take us around, you know, the Falls Road and the Troubles and all of that and talk to us about it. And he did. And he took us to the really gritty bits. And it was extraordinary to see literally how close, you know, Catholics and Protestants were and still are. And the kind of the division and the, you know, the hatred between different sides of the street.
Oh,
growing
yeah.
up with that, you know, as to your point, you know, you normalize that level of fear.
It was surreal, really. And, you know, it's interesting you talk about the Falls Road. So one of the first hospitals I worked in was on the Falls Road. There's a hospital there called the Royal. So my early training was in the Royal. But where I lived was in a flashpoint place called Ardoyne. They might have taken you there, actually, because they have a lot of the murals on the wall.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I remember the murals. Yeah.
So I grew up there. Wow. In that flashpoint. So we were kind of stuck in the middle of this kind of Protestant and Catholic area. And I grew up in a predominantly Catholic area. And that entire experience, actually, I mean, the people were, I mean, people in Northern Ireland, they do have a warmth about them that's kind of hard to match.
Yes.
But the constant set, you know, that sense of fear that was the whole time, when I look back on it now, I do think that that was way tougher than I realized. And and I guess as an adult sometimes when I'm talking about anxiety, I never really understood some of my own hypervigilance and mistrust of safety particularly.
That's interesting that that hypervigilance comes from that place of uncertainty. And, you know, I've got a couple of friends who I actually tease about being hypervigilant. And I actually quite like hanging out with them because they spot things, you know, way before I do. I always say, you know, you should be a spy because you've got like, you know, extra sensory perception and x-ray vision here. But they've both had quite troubled, traumatized backgrounds. And I guess we carry a lot of that kind of stuff subconsciously, don't we, into our adult life?
I think you do. And it's kind of one of the things I try to talk about in this book, is that concept that we're all products of our experience. You know, no matter who we are all products of the things that we experience in life. And of course, when you're going through this stuff, you don't really know that that's happening for you. But, you know, it depends on which psychology models you're talking about. People often talk about the shadow or the unconscious. And, you know, you'll hear different language. But I try to simplify it in that sometimes difficult things happen in our lives, difficult experiences happen. We go through things that are not easy. And I think we store it all up. And I often describe it like these kind of, there are core parts of everyone, regardless of who you are, that store up these things. It could be that you have a sense of not feeling safe. You may have a sense of not feeling loved, not feeling good enough. It plays out in different ways for different people, but most people keep that stuff really secret. Rarely do you see anyone coming out saying, oh, I sometimes feel unlovable.
Right.
Or I sometimes feel powerless. Or I sometimes feel like I worry I'm going to be disowned or abandoned or whatever. But the reality is a lot of human beings walk around with that stuff very deeply buried within them, and they carry it. And it doesn't play out all of the time, but often, and then I think when life does become difficult, then the old stuff can stir up. And it's kind of almost like the temperature ramps up a bit and the old stuff starts to kind of get disturbed. And when that happens, I believe we're all made up of many different parts. And I think, you know, things like anxiety, anger, fear, defensiveness, reactiveness, whatever the pattern is in your life, these are all protective parts that we have, you know, these different parts of us. And often they come out to play, really, when the difficult stuff has been activated underneath. So when I'm working with people and they're saying, I don't understand my anger or I don't understand my anxiety, I always try to frame it in a way that these are just parts of you that very often step forward to try and protect these kind of more vulnerable parts, the kind of more issues. And when you start to see them in that way, then you can start to work with them. So rather than see, for example, anxiety is a bad thing, I often think, no, your anxiety step forward because it's trying to protect you. Or your anxiety or your anger step forward because it feels that it doesn't want you to get hurt anymore, or it doesn't want any more damage come. And that can be revolutionary life-changing for a lot of people, because they then think, all right, first of all, I think most people in my experience need to understand why they struggle. So when I meet a client and they come in and they start to tell me their life story, and very often it's difficult, you know, they've been through a lot of big stuff in their life. And, you know, and it's often the relief when you kind of frame it and say, well, it would be abnormal for you not to be struggling.
Yeah.
Moment, because most people come in feeling abnormal. Why am I feeling this way? Everyone else seems to be happier. Everyone else seems to have their life together, which is not true, by the way. That's the biggest myth there is. But most people, we believe, don't we? When we're going through a tough time, we believe everyone else has it together.
Yes.
But the reality is we get caught up in these beliefs that this is awful and it's abnormal and it shouldn't be happening. And I think when I'm working with people, and I really try to reinforce this in the book, that actually it would be abnormal not to be struggling, because very often the things people have been through, the residual impact is very understandable. So that can come with an enormous amount of relief, because people think, oh, I get it now. I understand why my mood drops. I understand why I withdraw. I understand why I get really anxious and worried some of the time. So it's kind of almost like you're getting people on side with themselves, thinking, no, this is okay.
Yeah. Is there also an understanding with what you're doing with the book that actually you and other therapists like you, you can't can't change people's lives. That individual has to make their own choices that will lead to change, and that the role of a therapist is really to nudge them in the right direction and open up that possibility.
Yeah, what you're doing the whole time is, and like I'm really clear about this in How to Be Your Own Therapist, you know, this is not like a messiah, I'm coming to save you. You know, no therapist, let's be really honest about this, no therapist is coming to save you. No one is coming to save you. You've got to do the work yourself. But I think for most people, it's, you know, most people, myself included, sometimes we just need you need someone else to kind of put a spotlight on it to give a perspective that sometimes we can't find ourselves. And I guess really I see my job is to point out stuff that maybe the individual won't see or spot, and to try and make that understandable. And more importantly, to then offer not solutions, because most people find their own way, but I am, you know, and therapists never give direction as such. But I think very often, you know, I'm not a therapist who will just sit and nod their head for an hour, because I just think, well, I you get that with your best mate and a couple of glasses of wine.
Yes.
So, and you, a little bit on top of it.
Action points.
But you can, and you are given some degree of direction, saying, I wonder, have you thought about this? I wonder, could you try that? So it's always about this kind of open curiosity about, I kind of wonder what you could be doing. And that is the hardest thing in the world, because it's kind of in our nature, isn't it? We want to, I think when you're struggling, when you come along to somebody, you kind of want someone to feel, this is terrible and it's awful and it shouldn't have happened and this shouldn't be happening. So there is that moment at the beginning where people kind of think, I just kind of want to stew in this for a while, because it just feels terrible. But I guess ineffective therapy is if you let people stew in that for a long period of time, then they get stuck.
Yeah.
So I guess really what I try to do is, you know, I will always let people tell their story, and I'll encourage them to tell their story. And of course, you know, you're compassionate and empathy and all of that in abundance at the beginning. But then there comes a point, it's like, okay, well, would you like to stay here?
To which the answer must be no.
Well, most people say, yeah, well, no, of course I don't, but what can I do?
Yes.
And then I guess that's the point, that what can I do is, well, actually, there's a lot you can do. Mm-hmm. And I guess therapeutically then, that's when literally you're sort of reaching out the hand to help them up, so to speak.
Do you think then that everyone could benefit from therapy?
Oh my God, 100%.
I mean, really? So no, not just when we've reached a clear crisis point. You know, you talked before about depression, anxiety, uncertainty, fear, you know, but you think that actually even anybody listening who thinks, well, I'm not depressed and I'm not particularly fearful. What, you know, what's in it for me?
Yeah, I mean, look, there are two ways of looking at it. I think it's, you know, most people would benefit from a personal trainer, you know, because it's like, you know, it's that encouragement and the guidance and stuff is really helpful. I'm not saying that everyone would want to do that, but I think that, you know, we'd probably argue strongly it wouldn't be unhelpful to have somebody guiding you through that part of your life. And I think most of us, you know, and some people might disagree with this here, but I think, you know, maybe my opinion's a little bit biased, but I think most people have never really been taught how to manage the big stuff. Most people haven't been taught how to manage the negative thoughts that go on in their mind.
Sure. I mean, but where would you get that information from? You know, unless you've got incredibly enlightened, communicative parents.
Absolutely.
Which certainly, I mean, my generation, I mean, I'm 60, so, you know, I look at my parents and you know, they had no tools. We didn't even talk about this. I didn't even know what therapy was until I was about 35.
Well, exactly. And it kind of seemed for me as well, as it was that, as I said earlier, that culture of just get on with it. And, you know, as I would say in Belfast, they have an expression over there, catch yourself on. So everything was minimized.
Really?
So you didn't really, it was just kind of like, there are more important things than your emotions. So, you know, just keep moving forward. But we're not taught very often how to manage the difficult emotions. We're not taught how to manage the thoughts. Very often, we're not really sure how to regulate all of this stuff. So I have a theory that a lot of adults crash land into adulthood and they get on with it, but then suddenly a crisis moment happens and things can feel like they're falling apart. So I think therapy, in a sense, is that this kind of understanding these thoughts that you have. And let's be honest about it here. You know, every single person listening in here today will have moments when they are aware that their mind is telling them that they're rubbish, that they're a failure, that they're not good enough, that they're stupid, that they're too big, they're too small, they're ugly. These voices exist for most people, these critical voices in our head. And the problem with that is most people take them factually.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, actually, in fact, quite a critical question here. Is there a difference then between thoughts and feelings?
100%. It's a brilliant question, because people often mix up the two. So thoughts are these, you know, narratives that just go on in our mind. And because they're so automated, and, you know, in cognitive behavioral therapy, they often talk about automatic thoughts. So these are the thoughts that just jump up automatically. They're just these narratives, almost conversations that go on in our heads. And very often they're just old patterns and responses that play out over and over and over again. But they're familiar, and you will be familiar with that voice. It's like, oh, there you go again. Yes. Or you screwed up again. You're an idiot. So we all know what it sounds like. Feelings are a little bit different. So feelings are those kind of almost visceral internal changes that go on where you literally feel, I describe it almost like it's like a wave moving in, where you suddenly become aware that something more significant has landed, where there's a real change. Now, the difficulty is most people never stop to work out what the change is. All they do is they say, well, I'm not feeling the way I felt earlier, mm-hmm. or I'm not feeling great, or I just can't be bothered today. So often people will frame it quite broadly. But I guess really when you're a therapist, you're digging around a bit, and then often what you'll find is, you know, people saying stuff like, actually, I'm feeling really sad. You know, when you start digging around, I'm feeling really sad today, or I'm feeling overwhelmed, or I'm feeling isolated. So it's interesting how it often just gets dressed up broadly. But then when you start to explore a bit, you find quite significant feelings there. And I guess what I'm always interested in is that the feelings are there for a reason. They're not bad. Again, they can be used very powerfully to navigate you back to a point of stability. So if a difficult emotion moves in, I'll always work with a client and say, okay, I wonder what the emotion could be communicating. Mm-hmm. I wonder what it's trying to tell you. I wonder where it's trying to lead you to. So rather than the emotion being seen as a bad emotion or a negative emotion, I can, like, God, I wonder what it would be like to see all of the emotions as equal. Mm-hmm. You know, the great emotions are happiness, joy, love, blah, success, you know, these things that we all gravitate towards. But I wonder what it would be like if you could kind of incorporate all of them, so that when an emotion comes up, firstly, you're curious about what it is and you give it airtime, and then you allow the emotion to communicate. So, and often they are, it's kind of, you know, slow down, reevaluate, rethink, always kind of trying to get us back to a point of stability.
So are feelings then a byproduct of thoughts? And if so, is it easier to change our thinking that will then inevitably move our feelings up to a perhaps a more positive level?
It's the age-old question, and you know, psychiatrists and psychologists and therapists across the board will argue it differently. So in, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, you know, they often talk about the impact of the way you think will impact the way you feel. Mm-hmm. But then you can get this feedback loop where actually if the emotion's quite strong, it may be that then impacts in the thought. So say, for example, sadness moves in and it's really a strong feeling of sadness. The thoughts then might be quite melancholic,
right,
or darker in nature. So it's kind of almost like, I don't think there's a concrete answer to say, you know, one leads to the other. I think as human beings, we're complicated, you know, in the sense that stuff's moving the entire time. And to kind of prescriptively say, yeah, it all starts with the thought, or it all starts with the feeling, we are way, way more complicated than that. But I guess really, you know, the two are intertwined. So when I'm working with people, it's always about pulling them back and say, okay, let's not get completely involved in the emotion. Let's not get totally involved in the thought. But at the same time, let's acknowledge it and be aware that it's there and be curious about it. Because then you create that, you create the openness really for something to happen. So the whole time you were talking earlier about energy. So I kind of think, well, when you create the openness and space around it, then you allow that energy to pass through.
I love that differentiation between thoughts and feelings. Hold that thought and let's hopefully feel the need to move forward. We're going to take a break. But when we come back, I do want to get into exactly what we need to be doing to become our own therapist.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Well, you know, I can imagine a lot of people might never start the therapy process, not because they don't want to, but because it just seems so big and so unwieldy and with all these strange terms we've never heard of before. Where on earth do we start? So, you know, we'll come on to your ongoing manageable daily tips in a moment, but where would you suggest that someone starts in just understanding their story?
I mean, look, the first half of this book is about, you know, I should premise that this book doesn't claim to be a replacement for therapy in any way, shape or form. You know, I think there are some times in life when therapy, individual therapy or even group therapy, depending on what's on offer, could be a really useful thing. But, the realist in me recognised when I sat down to do this book that there are millions of people in the UK waiting for therapy and they can't get treatment because of wait list. Yeah. And there are millions of people who can't afford private therapy. So that's kind of really what motivated me to do this book. It's like, well, okay, I'm not claiming this is going to be a replacement, but it's a pretty decent starting place, because why don't I share what I know from 30 plus years of working in physical and mental health? Why don't I share what I see work on a daily basis with people? Mm-hmm. And, you know, therapy, it's a good point you make about it being daunting and big, because actually it doesn't need to be that way at all. And what I've tried to do here is, I think for most people, it always has to start with their story. You know, just giving people the opportunity, and the book does that, to tell their story. Mm-hmm. And not just because here's the interesting thing, Liz, if I ask you to tell me your story today, I'd put money on it. And I say this respectfully because it's the same for all of us as human beings. What you'd probably do initially is you would give me the respectful version of your story.
Of course.
we all do, don't we? Because we do not want to go to the kind of the grittier stuff. So we all kind of get quite used to doing this. You know, we kind of just tell these sort of, this may bring this alive a bit more. So my first therapist ever was the story behind this, I should tell you the story actually, because it does make sense. So I hadn't been to therapy before, and I was living in Ireland at the time, about to come out to my family and all of that sort of stuff. Irish and Catholic, so you can imagine the drama that went with that, you know. And to make it even more complicated, I, in my early 20s, was training to be a priest at the time.
Oh my gosh.
So my parents one day thought they had a future pope in their hands.
Okay.
They're going to say they have a nice gay son in the car.
So right,
it's a picture of the landscape. Mm-hmm. So I got myself very stressed out about this whole thing, as you can imagine. So it was a big bombshell to be landed. And a mate of mine said, I think you should go and talk us through with somebody. And I went, and they just gave me a card and a name, and I arranged an appointment. And when I got there to this building, I first of all noticed it was in a school, which I thought was a bit weird. And I thought, why am I in a school? This is weird, but it's definitely at the right address. And then I knock on this door, and this nun answered the door.
Oh, gosh.
I said, oh, I'm really sorry to disturb you. I think I might be at the wrong place. I'm looking for someone called Kathleen. And she said, that's me.
Okay.
And I said, I'm looking for Kathleen. And it's interesting, I couldn't say the word therapist. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting, because it was all a bit shameful. And I said, oh, no, this is just this lady. And I think she talks to people. So I started to bumble and dabble about all sorts of stuff. And she said, do you mean the therapist? And I went, yeah. And she said, that's me.
Wow.
So she then brought me in. So there I am, my first experience with a therapist, sat in front of an Irish Catholic nun.
Right.
And my reason for being in therapy is to come out as gay. And the whole, so there's so many conflicts and contradictions in it that none of it made any sense whatsoever. But the incredible thing about it was,
How did it go?
Well, here's the thing. She sat me down and she was like, how are you? And there is a point to all of this. So she said to me, how are you? And I started to go into my rehearsed story.
Yeah,
I'm good. I'm fine. Mm-hmm. And how's it been growing up? I mean, she knew where I lived. I mean, this was in Belfast, so she knew exactly what the background was. So anyway, she let me ramble on for about 20 minutes. And then she said to me, I've just noted, Owen, that you keep telling me that you're fine.
Yeah.
And that everything's fine. She said, I'm just curious about why you're here.
Yeah.
So I just went quiet and I had nowhere to run, really. I didn't know what to say. Sure. And then there was this incredible moment of silence. And then she said, you keep telling me you're fine. But she said, it's interesting because I feel really sad. And I'm wondering, do you feel that? Mm. And you know, when someone not corners you, but when they name mm-hmm. exactly what's happening, mm. that you've nowhere to run.
Yeah.
And of course, then the emotions then.
Yeah. Yeah,
they had to come, and then suddenly I could barely speak.
Yeah,
and then that was it. Really, that was the beginning of an incredible relationship. So at the end of the session, she said, "I think we're going to end here, but let's start again." She said, "Do you want to tell me why you're here?"
Really?
After all of that, yeah. So I said, "Well, actually, I've got a bit of a secret thing going on at the minute." So she said, "Okay." So again, there was a bit of kind of babbling going on and avoidance and all sorts of stuff. And so I had, and she just kind of was very quiet. And then eventually I said it, and there was just a deadly pause. And she said, is that it?
Really?
And I said,
amazing
yeah,
woman.
It. And then she said, she said, I thought you were going to tell me you'd murdered someone.
Gosh, and, how incredible to put that into just such perspective and
it was,
make
and
you feel comfortable.
And she was great and funny and down to earth and all of that stuff. But the importance of that story is, I mean, it kind of demystified therapy for me, but it was a very human face on something that I expected to be different.
Do you think we should expect the process of therapy then to be uncomfortable emotionally?
Absolutely. Look, I think first of all, if you're ever thinking of getting a therapist, you know, it has to be the right therapist for you. I say to every client I meet, I do an assessment with them first, but I often say to them, go away, think about this. I will, if I think I can work with them, I will offer them that. If I think I can't for whatever reason, then I'll be truthful about it and say, I'm not the right person for you, and here's why. But equally, I'll say to them, if I'm not right for you, please do not book another appointment with me, because you're going to be wasting your time and money.
How do people find the right therapist, though? I mean, are there key questions to ask or specializations?
I think there's the normal due diligence stuff. Check that this person is trained, that they have full accreditation. There's a real difference between having a membership of a regulatory body and having full accreditation.
Okay.
And a lot of people who maybe are not fully trained will say they have membership, and that's
right.
Fine. And they may not have finished their training, but if you're with somebody who hasn't completed their training and you feel they have completed their training, then you are going to get a different experience. It doesn't mean that it won't be a helpful experience, but I think you check their experience, that they're accredited, that they come with a good reputation, ask for reviews. But I kind of often think that the most powerful thing is to, you know, if you know somebody who's been to therapy and they found someone good, is to kind of, you know, maybe go and meet them and go along. You know, it might be that the first person you meet isn't right for you, and you might need to see, you know, I've been to therapists that haven't worked for me at all.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
and I've had to. So I think it's finding the right person, but somebody that you intuitively know that and safety and trust with. Because if you go in and bullshit, and people do.
Yes.
If you go in and bullshit and don't tell them the truth, and you go in and just kind of put on the happy smile and you say, oh, I can't tell them that. My God, what would they think?
Yeah.
Which was my big fear. How would you go in and talk about all
well,
of this?
Well, you were thrown in the deep end.
How do I tell this stuff to a female, which was an interesting thing.
Sure.
To a woman about this stuff, because I'm going to be talking about sex to a woman.
Yeah, and a nun.
And a nun. and it's not even regular sex.
Well, let's get into the practicalities of what you suggest in your book, which is brilliant, about what our days can look like. You know, you talk about 10 minutes of daily self-therapy.
Yeah.
You know, so we don't need a therapist. You know, we get the book, we go through this. What would that 10 minutes look like? And is it something that we have to do every day?
Well, so I should say the first half of the book is about telling your story and getting to know your story. And it's kind of almost like a jigsaw. It's really, you know, kind of guiding you through your life story and how it makes sense to your life today. So I guess it's really helping you understand why you might struggle, and you would do that in regular therapy. So you're kind of, I guess really it's like you're kind of joining the dots to think, okay, now this makes, so that's the foundational part of the first half of the book. And that's exactly, you know, and I think I couldn't have done the book without doing that first.
And do you write that down, or do you record it in some way?
I ask people to do it in whatever way is comfortable for them.
Okay.
If they want to write, they can write. If they want to record, they can record.
Mm.
If they want to paint or poet, whatever works.
Okay.
It's just about getting that out. But then the other part is choosing a trusted person to share the kind right. of the unedited version of the story with.
Mm.
So that for the first time you're sat down. I spent 10 years working with people who were terminally ill. And the number of times I was with people along the way who would sometimes be at the end stages of their life, maybe sometimes in their 70s or 80s, and they would often tell you stuff they had never told anyone in the entirety of their life ever.
Gosh.
And they carried it right up to that moment.
Mm.
So I kind of think, you know, often we carry some of this stuff, and often it's shame based. Yeah. Often people carry all this stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like, oh my God, I couldn't tell people that. And of course, often the shame's unnecessary. I often, like I say in the book, the anecdote to shame is light. You know, shame cannot survive in the dark.
That's so great. I actually had somebody not that long ago who shared a really deep secret with me because they felt they were in a trusted space.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, to me, it was like, well, yeah, that sounds quite bad. But, that happened then. I don't think anything worse of you.
Yeah.
And they were like, really?
Yeah.
You know, and they've been carrying it around for years and not sharing it. I hope this kind of encourages people to think if there is something that you feel is just too shameful.
Absolutely.
If you have got somebody that you could share it with to bring it out into the light, it's what is that they say? Sunlight is an amazing disinfectant.
Absolutely. And it is the most powerful thing because I wholeheartedly believe that a lot. I do like the word disorders, and I don't believe in a lot of diagnosis. I think sometimes it's important, but I think sometimes we over-pathologize people. You know, we label them with depression, anxiety, OCD, ADHD. Mm. And look, don't get me wrong here. There are sometimes when a diagnosis, you know, in terms of getting people help and support and the right medication and stuff, I'm not saying that it's wrong. It does have a time and a place. But I also think we're in a culture at the moment where there's a danger that everyone's been pathologized.
Mm.
And I think we need to get much better thinking. We are human beings, which means sometimes we are going to struggle. We're going to feel low. We're going to feel anxious. We're going to feel a bit discombobulated. We're going to feel off center. That is part of the human condition. It doesn't mean that there's a problem or there's anything wrong with you. It means that you're a human being. And I think we have to get much, much better at having these conversations about the normality of struggle rather than this kind of over-pathologizing. But my point in all of this is really about this kind of culture we're in at the minute where we kind of almost need to have this defining label, which sometimes isn't terribly helpful. And I guess really when I'm talking about shame, very often what you find is that I see the top layer stuff as symptoms. So if someone comes in, they're anxious or they're feeling low or they're angry all of the time, it's often just symptoms of stuff that's going on underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of time, I rarely don't find shame.
Right.
At some level, when I'm working with people, there will always be some degree of shame. And yet it's a topic that we rarely talk about.
Yes.
Rarely talk about. And I think, often that's what's fueling the fire. This underlying sense of shame that people carry. Why don't we have these conversations about the fact that we carry these secrets? So that kind of informs a big part of the book. But in terms of the daily stuff, the reason I did 10 minutes was... I just kind of, there was years ago, I was running a group in the NHS and I was doing an anxiety group at the time and I was working with this group and they were doing really well, but I was setting them work to do between sessions. And this woman came up to me at the end and she said, like, this is really helping me. I'm really starting to feel better. But she said, I haven't got time to meditate for 45 minutes a day.
Mm-hmm.
I've got time to do all of this stuff. You know, can you create something like 10 minutes or something and I'll do that? So that informed my first book, which was 10 to Zen, which was creating that 10 minutes a day for anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was doing the therapy book and the therapy aspect of this book, I thought, you know something, I am very aware that people don't have a lot of time. And if I create this lengthy detail thing, people won't use it. I know they won't.
Mm-hmm.
So I divided it up into 10 minutes over the day. And it's in three sections, which I call ready, steady, reset. And I know that sounds like a breakfast cereal. But it does actually, that I say it out loud. It does.
Yeah, love it.
But the premise is really, I think, you know, most people get out of their beds in the morning and they just crash into their day.
Mm.
And you know, they're feeding the kids, walking the dog, and then suddenly they're in work and they're overwhelmed. And we're just on this automated cycle the whole time. And the first part of the day is kind of really encouraging and teaching people that kind of art form of stopping to check in, you know.
Yeah.
It's like
that. So would that be the meditation then, or how would you do that?
It's a grounding thing. I mean, I'm always cautious about the word meditation because I think for some people it can be off-putting because it just feels, oh, it's too woo-woo for me. But it is teaching people hard to stop and hard to regulate. So, you know, it's, you know, for it's a really simple thing of what is going on in your mind today. What's the activity like? What's the volume? What's the emotional state? You know, how do you locate these emotions? Where are you holding this in your body? Because then that's a really powerful start, because most people, you know, before you even get to the thoughts and emotions, most people carry stuff in the body. I mean, this is well documented. It's well researched. And there's a really quick route in to kind of regulating, because if, for example, you hold tension, I mean, I can ask you if you don't mind me, where do you hold when you're struggling? Do you know when you carry tension or
in my neck and my upper shoulders?
Okay, so that's your location. For me, it's my chest. For a lot of people, it's their stomach, their neck. But if you even do this kind of simple check and think, hey, what's going on with my body today, and you can locate where you're carrying the emotion, then you've got the opportunity immediately to kind of almost sit with that. And I often, you know, encourage just slow regulated breathing at in for four, out for four. Because when you do that, you activate the parasympathetic nervous system, which is kind of what you want to do here. You're trying to put the brakes on so that you can deactivate that sense of threat in the body. And then you're kind of, you're looking at the mindset. So, for example, if you're aware that you've woken up and you've got the, oh my God, you're rubbish, the day's going to be terrible, you know, it's a disaster, the catastrophizing and the whole work, you can then take a stand back and say, oh, okay, this stuff's playing out again. But there's a difference between seeing, oh, this stuff's playing out again, than qualifying that as I am terrible.
Right.
I am a disaster. This is all terrible. My life is terrible. So even that, the ability to create that space between, okay, I know what this is just my kind of critic playing out again, and I have a choice here to observe this and not to get over involved. And actually, I can even reframe this if I wanted to. So I guess the beginning part of the day is to really encourage people to get to know, you know, I describe it like getting into your car. You wouldn't get into your car in the morning and not check your seatbelt and your mirror.
And, much fuel's in the tank.
All of that stuff. You need to do that, and then you go off and it's going to be a pretty safe journey. If you don't do any of that stuff, are you going to hit a wall at some point? You probably will.
So that's getting ready, and then you get set during the day? So that's a different practice?
It's a different thing.
Steady.
And I encourage people. And the reason I included that is that I think most of us, unless you're very, very lucky, or depending on what your life is, but I know at some point, by about this point in the day, someone will have pissed me off. Let's be honest.
Just the one.
Maybe a few. There have been a few, actually. But there will always be a few things that have happened to kind of derail your day. Either people, circumstances, things not going to plan.
Trains.
Yep. You know what it's like. I mean, it's kind of like a slippery slope, isn't it? You can kind of start off full of good intentions, and then suddenly you get to this part of the day and you've derailed a bit. What I do advocate in this section of the day is to actually get out.
Yes.
So to not be in the house. Literally get out. And whatever capacity you can do that there, it's so that you break that routine of wherever you are. I mean, most people can find a way of getting out of the house or getting out of the office just to kind of break that up a bit. Now, I don't want to go too woo-woo here, but we know that small things, like even a few minutes walk a day can change
up. Oh, for sure. Try and find something green, some leaves, a bit of grass, something.
All of that stuff, even people get a bit cynical and they roll their eyes back. But when you look at the neuroscience behind it, you think, actually, no, it's really, really powerful. So it's again about that kind of navigate. Okay, I've now gone into a spiral. And then, of course, when we went to the spiral, the old stuff starts to get activated. You know, the old, you know, this is terrible. My life's a disaster. Why has this gone wrong? I won't cope with this. When you notice that spiraling beginning to happen, you've an opportunity then to kind of rescue it and self-therapy and think, okay, I'm not going to do this. There's ways of me managing this. And honestly, this can work really powerfully for people in just terms of leveling off the day.
Yeah. And then the last section, would that be, you know, before you go to bed or
yeah, what? And there's a couple of rituals I put in there in terms of how you end your day. You know, how do you do that? I mean, an old supervisor of mine years ago used to talk about, you know, cleansing your hands after every session. I actually think it was really weird. And actually, the older I get and the more experienced I got, I realized it was something really powerful.
You're washing off the day.
It's just literally kind of washing off the day. So I include a couple of other rituals in there. But the reason I talk about the end part of the day is if we're constantly just going on and we're not processing what's going on in our day, then we just carry the same stuff over and over and over again. So that part of the day, I do encourage people, whether it's journaling, recording, keeping a note of it somewhere, where they find a way of just offloading and not carrying whatever the concerns of the day are to bed with them. Because most people, look, if you think of anxiety and worry, for example, most people will carry 15, 20, 25 worries to bed with them at night.
Oh, gosh. That's a heavy load, hey?
It's a lot. And when you break it down with people, they will easily come up with a whole list of things that they're worried about and that are bothering them. Now, when you then kind of cross-reference that to the fact that kind of 90 to 95% of things that we worry about in this lifetime will never come to any fruition.
That's good to know, isn't it?
It's a lot of time wasted on worrying. So I let people, rather than hold this, I get people to do a thing called, I get them to do a list of worries and call worry time. And I include it in this section. I say, list down all the things that are bothering you before you go to bed. Don't take them to bed with you because it will be a very crowded bedroom with all of these worried them with you. So list all the stuff that's bothering you. And then go through the list and you can kind of make that decision. Okay, what am I in control? You know, what's within my control now? Can I do anything about this? And if it's not within my control at this moment, can it be okay to park this and to leave it be?
Yeah.
And for some people then what they find is that burden of carrying these 15, 20 worries is then suddenly narrowed down to maybe two or three key things. And then there's a greater sense of control and perspective back. So it's about basically this becomes a process and part of the day so that on a daily basis that you're making this decision to let go of the stuff that you don't need to carry with you. So that you're giving yourself the opportunity then to start the next day afresh, not heavily burdened. Whereas if we're not doing this, then we just roll in from one day to the next, to the next, carrying all of this stuff with us. And I don't think we need to do that.
Owen, you are absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for this conversation. So many really helpful and manageable suggestions. And I've loved our chat. Huge success with the book. I think it's absolutely brilliant. I can think of several people that I'm going to get copies and I'm sure it will be very helpful. So thank you for your time.
You're welcome. And thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed talking.
Well, Owen, thank you again so much for that conversation. I just loved all those hints and tips. I have definitely got a lot there to be taking away and getting on with. Interesting that he was talking about getting things out of your mind, last thing at night. And one of the things that I do now is I have a little notepad with a pencil beside my bed, and I do physically write stuff down that I'm worrying about, because I kind of feel that if it's written down, it's out of my brain, and my brain kind of subconsciously knows that I'm going to deal with it, but I'm not going to deal with it overnight. I'm going to use that time to rest and not worry and not stress, but get up and deal with stuff again in the clear light of a new day. Well, what about you? What do you do daily to help keep your mental health in check? Do let me know. You can leave a comment on our Instagram, which is at Lizarle Wellbeing. And if you want to connect with me personally, you can leave me a comment. I am at Lizarle Me. And while you're still here on your podcast platform, do make sure that you are following the show, because that way all the new episodes will arrive on your device as soon as they are available. And let me tell you, you will really want to be here next week, because I've got a bit of a Valentine's Day special for you. We are going to be learning how to really enhance our physical pleasure. I will leave you with that thought for the moment. Until then, go very well. Bye-bye. The Lizarle Wellbeing Show is presented by me, Lizarle, and is produced by Anushka Tate for Fresh Air Production, with additional production support from Ellie Smith.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.